Welcome to New Books in Journalism, the podcast where we talk about the latest works in journalism, media, and communication with the people who wrote them. I'm David Schwartz from the University of Iowa School of Journalism and Mass Communication. In this episode, we hear from Eric Deggans, media critic for the Tampa Bay Times. He is the author of Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. It's a remarkably current look at media's exploitation of race, gender, and region for financial gain. Eric Deggans, media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The book is Race Baiter, and the story behind the title of the book is fascinating, and we'll definitely get into that. But for our listeners who might not be familiar with you, just give us some background. Where are you from, and how did you get to where you are now?
Oh, okay. Well, right now I serve as a TV and media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, which is the largest newspaper south of Atlanta. And in that capacity, of course, I write feature stories, news stories, and things like that about television and media. So I cover radio, internet, all sorts of things. And I also do commentaries for TV on National Public Radio. And I write a bit for Indiana University's National Sports Journalism Center as well. And freelance work for other publications. And I basically came up through the ranks as a newspaper journalist. I graduated from Indiana University with a degree, double major in journalism and political science, and started working in Pittsburgh, first for the Pittsburgh Press and then for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette as a news reporter. But my goal was always to be an arts critic, so I went to the Asbury Park Press in New Jersey and was their pop music critic for almost 3 years. And that was a great sort of fertile environment because Bruce Springsteen lives there. Bon Jovi lives there. John Bon Jovi and the band Bon Jovi live there. Southside Johnny, Asbury Jukes, the Smithereens. There's just a ton of great rock bands that live right in that coverage area and read the paper daily. So I got to know a lot of those guys and cover them. And then I came to St. Petersburg to be their pop music critic because it was a bigger paper and a paper with a better reputation. It had already won Pulitzer's. And, you know, came there as their pop music critic and did that for about 13 months and then moved over to television because I felt like I could write about more things. I could write, everything sort of happens on television. So if you want to write about civil rights or if you want to write about race or if you want to write about gender politics or whatever, there's some corner of television where that's going down and you can talk about it in addition to being able to get paid to watch television, which, let's face it, is a pretty cool deal. So that's how I ended up at St. Petersburg, and now it's called the Tampa Bay Times.
And the book is called Race Baiter, the subtitle, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. And you mentioned there are more opportunities for TV there. Gender issues, race issue, culture, so many different things that you can write about in terms of TV. If I understand it right, the title of the book came from an incident on TV, or at least was somewhat inspired by it. Please explain how.
Sure. Bill O'Reilly, the star of Fox News Channel, called me a race baiter on his show in 2008. And I'm not exactly sure why he named me, quote, one of the biggest race baiters in the country, unquote. But I'd written several articles before that, taking issue with how he talks about race on his show. And he had just been through this this incident where he had tried to talk about visiting a well-known restaurant in Harlem called Sylvia's with Al Sharpton. And he was absolutely amazed that the people there were just like any other restaurant, and people weren't, you know, running around grabbing their crotches like they're in a bad rap video or something. And so it's on his radio show when he had one, and he got pilloried by the press, and I wrote something about it, and a lot of people wrote about it. And then he did this commentary on his show, said, you know, white people can't talk to black people about race anymore because it's just too easy to be called racist. And, you know, there's too many people making false allegations about race, too many race baiters out there. And he named Jesse Jackson, and he named Media Matters, which is a liberal-oriented media watchdog group, and he named me. at the time, then, and now, I served as chairman of the Media Monitoring Committee for the National Association of Black Journalists. And the National Association of Black Journalists is this group of you know, there's a lot of white journalists, obviously, who are members, but a lot of white journalists as well. It's a group that advocates for diversity in media. We believe that you can get more accurate coverage of people of color if newsrooms more accurately reflect the demographics of the city, of the area where they're based. So we try to boost diversity at all levels, particularly for African-American journalists. And this committee tries to take a look at stories that we see in the news mix that might be stereotypical, filled with stereotypes or prejudice or just off base and inaccurate in terms of black culture. And then we try to call people's attention to it and get the, you know, get them to change their approach. We offer training. We offer internships. We offer experienced members who can come in and work with news organizations if they want it. And for some reason, I guess, that is heresy to Bill O'Reilly. So so he called me one of the biggest race baiters in the country, and the only thing he mentioned was that I was chairman of this media monitoring committee. So as you'll see, if you pick up the book, you'll see in the introduction, I managed to weasel my way into a press conference that he was holding somewhere near my home. And I just asked him, you know, what he meant by calling me a race baiter. And he said, you know, he needed to see the exact verbiage of what he said, you know, back in 2008. But the thing is, he and I have sort of traded barbs in the press for many years. So he knows who I am. He knows my work. And he just did, he didn't want to engage. He didn't want to have a conversation. And, you know, I, for years, I told friends just the story as a joke. You know, can you believe that Bill O'Reilly called me a race baiter? And one of them said, why don't you, you should write a book about how when you try to talk about race, when you try to confront stereotypes and prejudice in media, a lot of times the people who are putting that stuff out there try to turn it around and call you a race baiter. And I was like, you know, that's a real good idea. So a year later, I had a proposal finished, and then 5 months after that, I had the book written.
It was, it's incredible that some of the references, you know, the book came out October or so, I believe, and there are references in there to March. You know, there's a,
I wrote it. I had my first deadline was the third week in March, and because the Trayvon Martin case was really blowing up, Trayvon Martin was an unarmed black teen who was killed in a Florida subdivision.
Sure.
You know, the world had to descend on the subdivision to get the prosecutors to file charges against the man who shot and killed him. That was happening in March. You know, so I had to rewrite the first chapter, and then right after that, Rush Limbaugh went after Sandra Fluck, and so that caused such a controversy. He lost so many sponsors, and that was such an embodiment of the hate culture that's is entwined on radio, that made, I had to rewrite the chapter on radio. So my deadline got pushed back to the second week in April. So that's when I turned to the book.
Yeah. Now, I'm still, as you tell, you know, sort of the story of the book, I'm still chuckling at what you said about O'Reilly and his trip, you know, into New York to, you know, to have, was it, I think, was it the meal with Al Sharpton. And it's almost like he was waiting for, you know, Danny Aiello to be waiting there behind the door for him.
You know, I don't know. What was weird, because like I said in the book, if you listen to the whole audio of it is on the internet, and if you listen to it, parts of it are very sort of perceptive, where he talks about how his grandmother was prejudiced because she didn't know any black people, and there was a lot of stereotypes in media that she believed, and he felt like she had gotten to know a few black people in her life, she wouldn't have been so prejudiced. But then he turns around and says this stuff about Sylvia's, and he says other things that are kind of insulting. And what's interesting to me about Bill is that every time he feels like a white person has been unjustly accused of racism, he feels like that harms the ability to talk about race. But he doesn't have anything to say when white people pass along prejudice directed at black people. So, you know, when Glenn Beck goes on Fox News and calls Barack Obama a racist, or you know, when another one of his compatriots, Eric Bolling, talks about a black legislator and tells her to get the crack pipe out of her mouth.
Right, right.
These are things I recount in the book, but there's several instances where people on Fox News have said really sort of hurtful and prejudiced things about black people. He doesn't have a problem with that. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, even if you accept his thesis that what Jesse Jackson does and what Media Matter does and what I do harm racial discourse, then you've got to also accept that those other people, Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh, all these people who say really hurtful, outrageous things about black people, that they also hurt racial dialogue. He never wants to talk about that part of it, because he understands that he understands who his audience is. And that's really the point of the book, is that a lot of the stuff that we see in media, stereotyping, the prejudice, the gender inequality, stereotypes about homosexuals, about any kind of disenfranchised group, and now any stereotypes about different subcultures of white people, it's all about making money. You know, it's all about sparking an audience or motivating an audience. And in many ways, it's degraded our trust in journalism. It's degraded our trust in each other. And people say they are aware of this stuff and they're not affected by it, but in fact, they really are. And the book is an attempt to sort of get people to think about this directly and remove it from sort of the fringes of their consciousness where they don't think about it so much. Get them to sort of focus on it front and center and really consider some of the messages that some of these people are presenting on their shows day after day.
No, I think this is a really nice segue into the book. In the first chapter, you talked about, you know, money ruling all, and O'Reilly. It's selective attention, it's selective perception, it's a lot of selection going on. You talked about the first chapter is even called downgrading all journalism. And sure. And you make a point of looking not just at Fox, but also at MSNBC. And I don't think they're as guilty. But sort of explain what you meant by downgrading all journalism and what the motives are of cable news.
Sure. Well, I mean, even in a universe where people are consistent opinion, you want to believe that you are getting your opinions from an honest broker, someone who is willing to consider the facts fairly and present a well-rounded argument. If they believe something, then they also allow that there may be another point of view out there, or they at least present a little bit of the other side and say, here's why my idea is better. If you ignore a pertinent fact that you know destroys your argument just because you want to make your argument, you're no longer an honest broker. You're not being honest with your audience. And what's happened in cable news is that there are very few honest brokers anymore. And I used, for MSNBC as an example, I used the way Al Sharpton is used on the network. When he was first hired as an anchor, I went on the record, I went on CNN, and I wrote a column for my newspaper expressing concern that the most visible African-American face on MSNBC was not that of a journalist and wasn't even that, really, of a media person, that of a civil rights activist, someone who was still running a civil rights organization and was still very much involved in trying to get certain kind of legislation passed, certain kind of legislators elected, certain kind of things done in government. And what we found in the middle of the Trayvon Martin situation was that Al Sharpton wound up serving as a mouthpiece for the family of the slain teenager and wound up leading rallies that were aimed at collecting money for the family so that they could press a legal fight to get George Zimmerman prosecuted for shooting their son. So there was this astounding day that I describe in the book where on March 22nd of 2012, Al Sharpton led a huge rally in Sanford, Florida, collected tons of money for the family, and then called off everything at 6 o'clock, took the family before MSNBC's cameras and did a whole hour show, Politics Nation, from Sanford. And then once the show was over, went right back, collected money, and representing the family. And, you know, what was interesting to me was that 18 months before that, Pete Olbermann and Joe Scarborough, both MSNBC anchors, got suspended for giving money to Democratic candidates without getting an okay from NBC News. 18 months later, Hal Sharpton can collect money for a family at the heart of the biggest news story on the planet at the time, and there's no problem.
Right.
And I think viewers see that, and they sort of go, okay, their thumb is on the scale, and they're not honest brokers anymore. You know, they have a dog in this fight. They have a serious dog in this fight. And that's when it gets to the point where people don't trust what they see. We just had a poll come out yesterday by the Public Policy Public Policy Polling is the name of the organization, and they found that Fox News was the most and least trusted news organization on television at the same time. You know, they polled 41% of them trusted Fox News the most. That was the highest percentage of trust, and then 47% or 49%, something like that, distrusted them. And what was interesting was that Fox News's trust and distrust levels, sort of the trust level went down by 6 points, 7 points, and the distrust level went up by more than 10 points from the last time they did the survey last year. So this partisanship in cable news is really degrading people's confidence and trust in all journalism outlets. People see how easy it is for Sean Hannity or an Ed Schultz or an Al Sharpton or a Bill O'Reilly to twist the facts of the situation to serve their argument. And then I think sort of lose faith in journalists in general. And, you know, we saw Bill O'Reilly just yesterday go on his show and complain that NBC had not covered the drone scandal, this memo that was unearthed by his organization outlining the president's legal justification for using drone strikes to kill suspected terrorists, even American citizens, without due process. And, you know, Bill O'Reilly went on and on his show about how NBC was not covering this. And NBC broke the story. An investigative reporter for NBC News was the person who found the memo and did the story that broke the news. And NBC News and MSNBC were talking about that story all day. The day that he broke it, I think it was Monday or Tuesday. So, so when you have something that simple, you know, a cable news host who won't even acknowledge that a rival news outlet broke a news story that he's saying they didn't cover, because, you know, sending the message that NBC is soft on news that, you know, makes the president look bad, that's more important than getting the facts right. You know, that's what affects people's credibility. And so, you know, the first chapter of the book just talks about how, even though MSNBC seems to be a little more fact-based, to me, MSNBC is just a little further down the road than Fox News is. MSNBC is going down the same path. They're just not as far along. They do have hosts that twist the truth in the same way some of the Fox News people do. You know, they have their own ethical lapses that they've had to apologize for. And that's one of the big differences is that they will apologize quicker than Fox News will, but they still make some of the same mistakes, serving their ideology first rather than trying to be honest brokers of information.
You know, the poll that you brought up, I saw the numbers as well a couple of days ago, and I thought it was interesting. And you know, when I was reading the book, I was wondering, one question that I had is whether people notice. You know, if they were aware of Al Sharpton's conflict of interest and whatnot. But I think that poll shows maybe they are aware, because the personalities on Fox and the personalities on MSNBC from 2008 to 2012, or the current, some are the same, most of the same. There's been a little bit of turnover, I guess, especially at MSNBC, but the content is the same and the vitriol is the same. So I guess the fact that we see those numbers changing, the fact that people are starting to doubt what they see and to challenge what they see, maybe that is a little bit of hope that there is a bit of a discriminant consumer out there. And it's not just people willing to digest whatever is fed them.
I think what's happened with Fox News is, you know, the conservative media can create this sort of cocoon of opinions, but every so often reality intrudes with a vengeance. You know, one of the first times we saw this happen was with Hurricane Katrina. You know, there was no spinning away the government's inability to deal with that crisis. There was no way to avoid the fact that these Republicans who said that the government couldn't do anything kind of made sure that happened. and that there are some things that government really does need to do for people, specifically help out when a disaster strikes. And then the economic crash was another bit of reality intruding. And I think the elections in 2012, this was an election that came after 4 years of intense effort by partisans to defeat President Obama. And conservative media pulled out all the stops and had their audience convinced that Mitt Romney was going to win. And so when that didn't happen, you saw a lot of people scrambling to try to explain it. And for example, you know, Dick Morris, an analyst for Fox News, lost his job there. You know, Karl Rove taking a lot of criticism from people because he spent $300 million. And conservatives lost seats in the House. They lost seats in the Senate. And they didn't recapture the White House like they said they were going to do. So every so often, reality intrudes into that cocoon, and people realize that they're being sold a bill of goods in a way. So I think Fox News's dip in trust is due to that part. They were just past an election where they got a shellacking. But if reality doesn't intrude for a while, I think that cocoon starts to reshape, and people start to drink the Kool-Aid again, and it'll take another sort of horrendous intrusion of reality to kind of break that spell again for some people.
Sure, and this topic is fascinating. The whole book is, and I want to make sure that we have time to get through as much as we can. And I want to jump ahead a little bit. You have this great phrase of race relations as collateral damage, and it's one of those turns of phrase that sort of kicks you right in the gut. That it takes a recklessness with something so important. You know, there's this myth of the post-racial America and whatnot. Please take a few minutes to elaborate on what you meant by race relations in terms of collateral damage and this racial carnage that's being left behind, you know, trying to make a buck and gain viewers.
Sure. Well, what these cable channels in particular are doing, but most of the media outlets I'm talking about, they're doing a couple of things. The first thing they're doing is they're reflecting sensibilities and the fears of their audience right back at them, right? So in Fox News's case, they're reflecting back the idea, you know, there's studies and surveys that show that the Fox News audience is overwhelmingly more likely to feel that white people are just as likely to be discriminated against in America as people of color. You know, the Brookings Institution study found 70% Fox News viewers feel that way, as compared to 46% of sort of the average population. So your Fox News viewer is someone who feels that efforts to equalize things for people of color are really a disadvantage against white people because the playing field is already level, and people and liberals just won't admit it, right? So Fox News kind of reflects that idea back. Having hosts who are very skeptical about things like affirmative action. They're very skeptical about claims of discrimination lodged by people of color unless it's incredibly blatant. And they're skeptical of attempts to create government programs that equalize things for people of color because they don't feel there's any equalizing to do. They feel like if you work hard and put your nose to the grindstone, anybody can be successful in America, which is a nice thought. You know, look at income levels, you look at arrest records, you look at illness and sickness and health care, and, you know, any indice you want to look at, you'll see that people of color, black people, do far worse. They earn less money, They have more serious illnesses. They're more likely to be arrested. They're more likely to be arrested for serious crimes. They're more likely to be sentenced to death. And I just, you know, it's crazy. So obviously, if you look at the stats, they're not equal. But that's not the world that Fox News reflects back to its viewers. Then the other thing these outlets do is they reflect the fears of their audience back. So what's the ultimate fear of a conservative who feels like the playing field is level and there's a black man in the White House who is sort of inimical to their perspective? Well, the worst case scenario is you have a black president with a secret agenda to use the government to give free things to people of color who don't deserve it. And so that's a thing that constantly comes up when you watch, particularly the commentators on Fox News. There's this vigilance. There's something wrong about Obama. There's something weird about him. He has a secret agenda. He has these secret advisors. You know, he's pushing these secret plans. You know, it's always, you know, there's always some secret conspiracy. But that's a fear of the Fox News audience that they're constantly kind of reflecting back at them in order to make the channel feel comfortable to them. And then the final thing is that racial conflict can draw attention. When I was talking to a professor who studied some of the online conservatives like Breitbart.com and the Daily Caller and the Drudge Report, this professor feels that they use racial conflict in the same way that the yellow journalists use tabloid-style news stories to draw an audience at the turn of the century. So you can draw a crowd by creating a racial conflict. But unfortunately, the ultimate result of all of this reflection of fear, reflection of sensibilities, and using racial conflict as an attractor, it winds up creating the schism. So Fox News viewers are overwhelmingly white. And then MSNBC, which has you know, a much more diverse anchor lineup, it's much liberal in its policies, so it embraces programs that might benefit people of color. It comes from the idea that there is institutional prejudice, there is institutional racism, there are these problems that need to be corrected. So, of course, they have more viewership amongst people of color. They have much more viewership amongst black people. And so already you sort of have a segregation on the dial where more people of color are watching MSNBC, Fox News is overwhelmingly white, and they're espousing two different visions of people that are kind of in conflict with each other. Now, that's news. I also talk about how this happened scripted TV programming, where on Thursday night, remember, NBC had this great lineup called Must-See TV, and, you know, Friends was on, and Seinfeld was on, and Frasier was on, and, you know, all of these Mad About You, all these super popular sitcoms from the 90s.
Right. I remember they responded with Aisha Tyler coming on Friends, and to this day, she jokes on her own podcast about how she broke the color barrier at NBC Must-See Thursdays.
Union after Aisha Tyler, they tried twice to make that show and it failed. So those shows were very sort of monochromatic. So when Fox came along, Fox Entertainment, the Fox Network, the Fox Broadcast Network, they wanted to compete. They wanted to start a fourth network. Well, how could they compete on Thursdays? Well, they had to build shows around people of color because that was the audience that wasn't being served by Seinfeld and Friends and Mad About You. So they created, Living Single was before Friends, but they created Living Single with Queen Latifah. They created Martin Lawrence. They created In Living Color, which had Keenan Ivory Wayans and Jamie Foxx. And
David Alan Greer, sure.
Yeah, and New York Undercover, a show about two police detectives, one black and one Hispanic. You know, all of their comedies and dramas were very diverse and focused on really talented and up-and-coming performers of color. And so once that got going, then you had a situation where white people were watching NBC and people of color were watching Fox on Thursday nights. So I distinctly remember this. I was working in New Jersey, and I would go into work on Friday, and white folks would be talking about what happened on Friends or Frasier or Seinfeld. And Black Books would be talking about what happened on Mark for Living Single or New York Undercover. And Black Books had no idea who Jerry Seinfeld was, and White Books had no idea who Jamie Foxx was or who Martin Lawrence was. And so you had this segregation amongst the audience, segregation amongst what people were tuned into, that was this byproduct, this collateral damage of an economic attack. You know, Fox was trying to figure out how to make money on Thursday nights, so they programmed to an audience that wasn't being served. Nobody was really trying to create a segregated TV dial, but that's what they ended up with just by pursuing their own economic agendas. And so that's what I think what happens sometimes. You have these different media outlets that have these other reasons for why they're focused on what they're focused on. But the collateral damage is that you have these audiences that don't learn how to connect with each other and that don't share the same media experiences and really are encouraged to see the other side, like demonize the other side and see them as less than. And that doesn't really help anybody. And I think, I wonder, I'd never been able to have this kind of discussion with a Bill O'Reilly or a Sean Hannity or a Glenn Beck, but I wonder if they really even think that what they're doing causes that kind of damage, if they just kind of shrug it off and think, oh, you know, it's not as bad as the liberals say it is. But I think it's obvious. You know, when you look at the trust ratings, that same poll that we just talked about, Fox News, 29% of African-American respondents trusted Fox News compared to 57% of African-Americans who trusted MSNBC. And NBC News was also one of the most trusted broadcast networks for African-Americans because African-Americans don't watch those channels and feel like their sensibilities are being reflected in a way that Fox News does not.
It really would be fascinating just to see if you ever could have a dialogue with an O'Reilly or a Beck or someone, just to see, you know, first you wonder if they're capable of having a real conversation, you know, that's recorded. But
O'Reilly would be. The only problem, he would never have that conversation in a way that I could transmit to the world. Like I would hurt his brand too much. Just have an honest conversation about race. I think if trans, maybe in a few years he might get to willing to sort of drop some of the nonsense that he does and actually just have a conversation. But right now, it would hurt his brand too much. He would never do that publicly. And people like Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck, I think they're true believers. You know, I think they believe a lot of the crap they're slinging. So you can't have an honest conversation with them because they are just invested point of view that it'd be like arguing with a brick wall.
Right. You know, one thing I liked about this book, and you brought up before, is like you went beyond politics and you were looking at media as well, looking at gender and looking at primetime television and whatnot. And there's this really great narrative in there about Michael Patrick King, one of the minds behind Sex and the City, and then now the driving force behind Two Broke Girls, the Monday night CBS comedy, in which I think of the term as the upfronts, if I have that right. And the early screenings, there was one racial stereotype after the other coming up in the early episodes of the show. And the critics saw it, and the networks even seemed to somewhat acknowledge it. But in question after question after question thrown at King, he would just parry it or throw it back. You know, you mentioned he was even making sexual jokes about an Irish reporter or something along those lines. So I was encouraged there in that the media critics were really going after him, that were really seeing a lot of the things that you would maybe write about in the book. They were seemed to be cognizant of these visuals that he was creating. And yet, despite that, he was just unrelenting. Maybe just elaborate on that a little bit more and more about primetime television and sort of going beyond news now and what happens when those sorts of images are then reflected back on the viewing public.
Sure. Well, the incident you're talking about wasn't at the upfronts. The upfronts are where the networks reveal their new shows for advertisers months before they
actually. Right, I'm sorry. Wrong terminology. I apologize.
Describing was a press conference that was part of the TV Critics press tour, which there's there's a time in January and a time in July where TV critics from all over the country go to LA, and all the big TV programmers kind of roll out what they're going to have coming over the next 6 months. They hold press conferences for all their different shows, and TV critics get a chance to sort of ask questions of the producers and the stars. They're up on a stage and mic'd, and there's about 200 of us in a room, and we get to sort of pepper them with questions. Michael Patrick King, who's no stranger to this process, was seemingly not prepared for the fact that a bunch of critics thought the way that he depicted the two of our girls, particularly this Asian character, that it was borderline racist. And so when the questions started to come, you know, Michael did what he's done when he took those kind of questions about Sex and the City, which was he just basically said there's no problem. And part of his defense was that, well, hey, I'm gay, so I should be sensitive to these things, and I should be able to write this stuff. And, you know, a critic asked him, you know, so are you saying that because you're gay, you get to crack racist jokes? And he was like, oh, you know, it's it just all this whole ugly thing where, you know, the thing about those press conferences, and any critic who's attended them can tell you this, if a producer gets up there and says, the sky is green, when everybody knows the sky is blue, we are going to keep asking questions until you admit the sky is blue or the press conference is over. We're not going to let you insist that something is so when it's not, or is not when it is so. And the best way to defuse stuff like that is to just figure out a way to either admit that there's a problem, or kind of acknowledge that, you know, the criticism is valid, but you're doing something else. Or, you know, there's ways to parry those kind of questions without just simply denying everything. And because Michael just denied that the character was racist in any way, that enraged some critics to the point where they just kept acting. And what should have been, I mean, the show debuted to really high ratings. It's been a highlight of their Monday night stable in terms of ratings. So what should have been, they had just been nominated for People's Choice Award, and I think that night of that press conference, they were going to win it in their category. And so what should have been a victory lap became this really ugly thing because the producer would not listen to what critics were saying about the show. And that's often what happens in Hollywood. Again, they're, number one, these superstar producers have a lot of control. So when they decide to tell a story the way they want to tell a story, the last thing a network wants to do is get in the middle of that, even if they're telling a story that's racially insensitive or has prejudice inside of it or hysteria, stereotypes inside of it. If it's not so bad that it ruins the viewership for the show, then the network is not going to say anything. So Two and a Half Men can go on and on and on presenting this incredibly sexist sitcom with a star who is living a life that's incredibly dangerous to the point where he's physically threatening his wives and ex-wives and seems in danger of overdosing at any minute. And they would just tolerate it until literally he did everything but actually overdose in the middle of Hollywood Boulevard before they fired Charlie Sheen off that show. So that shows you how far a creative person has to step over the line before the networks will step in and do anything. So network TV tends to have a lot of stereotyping built up in some of the characters. They have what I call in the book the black best friend. Like they're afraid that shows that have too many people of color in them, I turn off white viewers, and because competition for audience is so intense now on network television, they won't risk that. But they will. But they also don't want to be criticized for having a totally white cast either. So, so there will usually be one or two people of color in a cast, particularly dramas, because you know, dramas are easy. They're usually ensembles. They're easy to have a few characters that are people of color, but they would usually have one or two people of color in the main cast of the show, and they're usually what I call the black best friend. They're supportive characters. They don't don't often get storylines of their own. There's usually not many other people of color in the show. We don't get to see much of their family or who they're married to or their kids or anything like that. And their role mostly to live the plot and to help out the main character. If you see a TV show like Grimm, which is about this cop who can see supernatural things, well, his partner is an African-American, and he's the classic black best friend. If he's not doing something that sort of moves the plot in an obvious way, then he is supporting the main character. He's counseling him. He's helping him figure out some stuff in his life. It's not like he has any mind. You know, his job is mostly the white main character.
He's a device.
He's a device often. And so I have a part in the book where I talked to this actress who's also a writer, and she was working on a pilot for Fox. She said the network had brought in all the top producers from their shows, and they had this long presentation on the change in demographics of the audience for network television. And then at the end of it, sort of the message is, you know, your cast need to be more diverse. And so, because she was an actress too, she was also seeing a lot of the scripts that were being churned out by these other producers in case she might want to try out for them. And, you know, magically, you know, second, third, fourth, fifth characters down the line were getting changed from white characters to ethnic characters. And so it wasn't as if that character was devised, was from the beginning as a person of color with a backstory and, you know, relatives and, you know, some kind of connection to the world. They just said, hey, let's make Tony, you know, Leroy. And suddenly, you know, he's played by a black actor. He's saying all the same things that was in the script when the character was white, but he's played by a black man now. And so it looks more diverse, but it's a very superficial kind of diversity. And it doesn't really create characters that kind of live and thrive on their own. And I think it also perpetuates a system where characters of color are constantly seen as support characters. It gets harder for viewers to see characters of color as the main characters in a story if most of the network TV shows that depict them as supporting roles. So, these are decisions that are kind of being made for economic reasons. You know, people, network executives, don't want to create a show that will turn off viewers. So they're very careful about how many people of color are in the show. And, you know, if you have a show like Undercovers that was on NBC, a spy show a few years ago, where the two leads were black, now the show failed. And I think a lot of critics who follow the show know that it failed because it wasn't a great show. They didn't write a particularly exciting series. It was a spy series in the era of Bourne Identity and the revitalization of the James Bond movies, and it was done on television. And so you can't travel to exotic locations, really. You can't spend a lot of the kind of money that you can spend on a James Bond movie making every episode of a network TV show. So it just, you know, it didn't quite work. But, you know, to the industry, it was a rare drama action show with two black leads, and it failed. Well, you know, how long is it going to be before that gets tried again? Now, NBC has another show with two black main characters called Deception that is sort of like a nighttime soap. And it's not doing very well in the ratings either. And so I have a feeling that that's going to end up being another cautionary tale. You know, NBC tried it twice, and it didn't work. Now, again, Deception is having a lot of problems. It doesn't have anything to do with the race of the leads, but... you know, network TV and the industry kind of learns the lessons it wants to learn. And so somebody like the star of Hawaii 5-0, Alex O'Loughlin, CBS's reboot, Hawaii 5-0, that guy was in two other series that tanked horribly before he got a shot at doing Hawaii 5-0. But sometimes actors of color don't get that same chance because the industry just decides, well, you know, NBC took a chance and it kind of tanked. We're not going there. So the politics of diversity in network television are very complex in that way.
You know, we've talked about, you know, race baiting cable stations that draw huge ratings. We've talked about sitcoms that have all these stereotypes that they get big ratings. It's kind of bringing me down. And I want to look at your chapter on hate radio. And not that Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Dr. Laura give me cause for hope in any way whatsoever. But you title the chapter, Why Talk Radio May Not Be a Haven for Angry White Guys Much Longer. And then you cite some examples in terms of how they might be spelling their own doom. And there might be some signs out there that perhaps there can be some more balanced and fair and progressive voices coming back to radio. And just talk about that chapter, if you would.
Sure. A lot of that chapter tells the history of how talk radio, particularly politically oriented talk radio, became this haven for very conservative, very angry white males. And so I talk about some of the early pioneers of the form, like Joe Tyne, who was on radio in the 50s. Bob Grant, who took over for Joe and then moved to New York City to work for this legendary radio station called WABC. And, Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck are both sort of acolytes of Bob Grant. And just sort of talking about, again, how the economic forces came together to create this brand of radio that was pioneered and championed by the largest radio station owner in the country, Clear Channel. And because Clear Channel had a corporate strategy that was centered on making this kind of talk radio sort of dominant in the industry, it wound up becoming a dominant force just by riding on the back of Clear Channel's dominance of the radio industry. But what's happened is that some of these hosts, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck in particular, they started out as more entertaining guys. They started out as more likable guys, poking fun at their political enemies instead of demonizing them. And now they've gotten to the point where they're so intense, they're so partisan, so bitter, and in Glenn Beck's case, paranoid, that I think they've even turned off a lot of the people, the fans. And they used to listen to the show to be entertained. And now these guys are so insulting and so intense. And I'm not just saying this as an observer. I've talked to program directors at talk radio stations who say, we can see the ratings for some of these hosts going down because people, in the end, they want to be entertained and they want to laugh a little. And these guys are so intense that it's just not fun for people to listen to them anymore. And so and the worm has kind of turned, and we've reached a point in talk radio where people are looking for something different. And, right now, the big corporations that control radio are looking at sports talk as an alternative. It's a place where people can argue about things, but the arguments are harmless for the most part. And it may be controversial to talk about the Ravens versus the 49ers, but when the dust clears, everybody knows it's just a football game. Right, which is a little different than arguing over drone strikes or arguing over welfare policy or healthcare policy. So I think some of the biggest companies in radio are now trying to find alternatives to this political talk because political talk attracts an audience that's older, that's dying out, and that frankly is getting less and less interested in these topics and more interested in being entertained.
You threw out the word entertainment just a moment ago, and it threw me to the section on the book about reality TV, and I don't mean to make this about me for a second, but the part about Flavor Flav and Flavor of Love, and I grew up in the 80s, and I'm a white male, so I could not identify a lot with Public Enemy, but nevertheless, I loved Public Enemy for the rebellion and the voice, and there was nobody like that. And then came Flavor of Love, and all this work that Chuck D and Flavor Flav and Terminator X had put forth, it seemed just to be just thrown away. And there's a whole generation of people who didn't know what they had done. And you've got this quote, and I hope I get his name right, but Jeff Old or Jeff Oldie, a VP at VH1, in which he says, "We didn't set out to make a show about race. We're just putting out a show for entertainment value." But this is some entertainment that could have some real damage, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. And again, you know, you bring up the term collateral damage. That's what the book is about. That's what I'm talking about. You know, these guys, clearly setting out to, I mean, some of them, obviously, because it's money-making formulas I talked about before, but some of these guys are just trying to create a show that attracts people and that grabs people and that makes an impact. And they're willing to minimize or shrug off or not focus on the collateral damage that occurs when you take somebody like Flavor Flav and you build a whole reality TV franchise around, you know, his dysfunctional, you know, lifestyle. And you take that lifestyle and you sort of turn it into the framework of the show that forces anybody else who's on the show to live that lifestyle as well. You know, people think it's all in good fun, but on the other hand, you're also encouraging these stereotypes, furthering these stereotypes, and, you know, frankly, glorifying a guy who really doesn't deserve it. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but I thought that quote really summed up, again, this idea that these guys are just trying to make money. They're just trying to make an impact. They're trying to make a show that they think a lot of people will watch. And they're so focused on that that when you come to them and you say, look, you know, this is a show that is filled with stereotypes about black men and women, and it's the kind of thing where if it was a scripted show, there'd be 50, advocates lined up to boycott you. Why are you putting this on the air? You know, they don't want to hear that. They just see dollar signs. So it's up to that. That's one reason why I wrote the book. I want to try and educate the viewers so that shows like that don't do well from the beginning. And so you don't have to persuade a producer to turn away from something that might be profitable or hurtful, because it won't be profitable. And the only way we can make it not profitable is to educate the audience enough that they avoid those kind of shows.
Sure, and we're just about done. I have one final question I want to ask you. I'm going to hold off on that and throw one penultimate question at you. I want to flip it back on the audience a little bit. We've talked about the networks and we've talked about the personalities and the producers. Fox draws big ratings. Two Broke Girls did ratings. Flavor Flav for a while. Flavor of Love did some really good ratings. What do you think it says about the audience that these shows that prey on stereotypes of gender and culture and religion and race, that they at times do very well? What do you think it says about the audience culture in this country?
Well, you know, one of the things I say early on in the book, like I try to set a framework for how to talk about this stuff. And one of the things I always say is that stereotypes are so, and people, because we know that racism is ugly, we presume and that the only people who would indulge them or fall prey to them are have the ideas about race. The fact of the matter is that they're always ugly. Sometimes they're seductive. They explain the world in ways that are very simple, easy to understand and easy to predict. And they're comforting because they're predictable. You know, if I can look at a Hispanic person across the room and feel like I know everything that they're about before I even talk to them, well, there's a certain level of comfort in that, because I don't need to get to know you. I don't have to run the danger of, you know, talking to you or dealing with you at all. I can look at you and I feel like I know where you're coming from and make my decisions based on that. In a way, that's comforting. So as the world goes more uncertain, there's a dynamic where people are encouraged even more to rely on stereotypes to navigate that world. So it says that the audience is particularly bigoted. I just think it says that the audience is not necessarily literate enough about how messages get put out there. I mean, ultimately, if I thought the audience really believed these stereotypes and prejudices, it wouldn't do any good to write the book, because they would just read the book and go, yeah, so what? You know, this is what I believe. But what the book tries to do is take these things that people don't think about that much directly and kind of put them on the table in front of them and say, have you really thought about this? Have you really thought about why this happens? Have you really thought about why that happens? Have you really thought about the impact of this or that? And the hope is that once you kind of put it on the table in front of people, they go, wow, yeah, you know, that is kind of not cool. And then they start to change what they consume in media. They change what messages they will allow to be presented to them. And they start to demand that some of these media figures find a different way to talk about these issues. That's the hope. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is media literacy. And I'm also some of these centers, some people think about them. And so what I think it says about the audience is that they just haven't thought about this stuff. And I think it also says that media creators of media are very professional and very slick, and they're very motivated, you know. And just like I said, the stereotypes are easier. You know, it's easier to create a show that's filled with a bunch of this crap rather than attract quality entertainment. You know, true excellence is difficult. It's much easier to create something down market that preys on people's worst notions and confirms their worst fears and a bunch of controversy. You know, it's much easier to do that. So, on the one hand, you know, I'm challenging the industry. On the other hand, I'm challenging the audience, challenge the industry. And hopefully, between those two, you know, at least eradicate some of this stuff.
The last line of the book is wonderful. It's time to save media and maybe even a divided America from itself. In the last chapter, you kind of sum everything up and talk about a way to move forward and a way for citizens to educate themselves and to create a dialogue. And what was your intent with the last chapter? What were you trying to accomplish?
Well, I sort of felt like I'd spent all these chapters kind of outlining all of this awful stuff out there. And I wanted the last chapter to be, okay, here's how we solve this. Okay, here's some answers. Okay, here's how we talk across race. Here's how we build better alliances. Here's how we connect through social media rather than disconnect. And here's what's possible if we sort of reject propaganda and media, if we reject the divisiveness and move towards something that's better. I just wanted the last chapter to be a little more hopeful and have some answers because, you know, in a way, it's easy to talk about what's wrong. Sometimes it's a little harder to give that other side of it, which is here's how you solve it. And ultimately, you know, I mean, I guess I have to be an idealist because ultimately the way you solve it is you have to change the audience. You know, we're in a media system now where the audience is getting more and more power. Just because media outlets are so fractured now that, you know, every outlet is desperate for attention. It's desperate for people to congregate. It's desperate for buzz. It's desperate for people to go on Twitter and say, hey, you know, check this out, or hey, check that out. You know, people, you know, when I went to get this book deal, you know, publishers were really focused on what's your social media, you know, do you have a Facebook page? How many people have a Facebook page? Do you have Twitter? You know, how many people follow you on Twitter? Do you go on, you know, cable TV news shows? Do you go on, you know, how often that, you know, that big a component is getting a book deal as anything else, because everybody's desperate for buzz. So, so the goal is to transform the audience, because the audience has the power. So if you convince the audience that, you know, Honey Boo Boo, watching Honey Boo Boo is like eating lard. It really is. It's the television equivalent of eating lard. So really, do you want to do that? You know? And if you convince enough people that that's true, then all of a sudden Honey Boo Boo is not a hit anymore. And we have this horrifically stereotypical depiction of Southern white people. And not only off here, we have a bunch of other producers who saw that audience go away and say, you know what, they don't want that anymore. You know, and so maybe the next thing they create is different. Right now, we have this whole spate of shows that stereotype different subcultures of white people, working class white people, because Honey Boo Boo is successful, and Duck Dynasty is successful, and a few other shows like that are successful. So if the audience stops watching those kind of shows, then they'll move on to a different kind of subject, because the ultimate goal is to attract an audience and make money.
Well, the author is Eric Deggans. The book is Race Baiter, How the Media Wields Dangerous Words to Divide a Nation. Eric, what are you working on now?
Well, really what I'm doing now is trying to get the book out there. This book is not something that you just kind of throw it out and, you know, 50 million people buy it. For some people, it's a tough sell at first, but if they hear me talk about the book, if they give it a chance, if they read a little bit of it, they'll understand that it's not a polemic. I'm not out there, you know, yelling and screaming at people, you know. And when I give presentations and people disagree with me, I'm happy to sit down with them and sort of talk through what it is that they disagree with me about. You know, maybe we'll agree to disagree. Maybe they'll convince me. Maybe I'll convince them. But, you know, I'm not somebody who's just going to be in your face, screaming at you, you know, intense ideologue. And I think the book is slowly gaining traction because people are slowly starting to realize that it's not just a hatchet job. It's not just a polarizing, you know, sort of pedantic kind of thing. So, you know, I'm doing a lot of appearances. I'm going to colleges. I'll be at Scranton, University of Scranton, at the end of the month. I'll be going to Savannah, Georgia. I'll be going to Los Angeles. I'll be going to Indiana, Hartford, Connecticut. I had to maybe Las Vegas. So, you know, there's a lot of schools are hearing about it. A lot of community groups are hearing about it. People are asking me if I can come out and speak. So I feel like people are just starting to get rolling. And it's been out for a couple of months already. So so right now my goal is to spend at least the first 6 months of the year just bringing the book to people, you know, going to schools, going to community groups, going to book festivals, and making the case that this is an important message. And you know, the year anniversary of Trayvon Martin's death is February 26th. George Zimmerman won't go on trial until sometime in June or July. So all throughout this year, there's still going to be things happening that are talked about a lot in the book. So I don't even feel like I'm talking about the past until we get to the end of this year. So you know, towards the end of the year, I'll probably start to think about what I might write about next. But you know, I have a lot of other jobs too.
Right.
Right now, the idea is to take this book to as many people as possible, and also keep up my work at the Tampa Bay Times and with NPR especially.
Well, Eric, this is a smart and important book. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. You've been listening to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find Race Baiter, written by today's guest, Eric Deggans, at Amazon and other retailers. Thank you for listening.